show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Here we go. 2 minutes past the hour on this, the 28th day of April 2015. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is where we live, and that's where you go if you want to check in with the gang in the chat room, which has folks wandering by even as we speak. Good evening to the folks who were on time. You get an apple today. No, you don't get anything. Oh, sure, you get something. Here, you get this. A ring of the cowbell. Yes, indeed. Good evening, Gerald. Good evening, Chug-a-Punch. Good evening, Texas P. And good evening to longtime, inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator, Sparky, who has folded space to become Man Cave this evening, him being Northern California's third stage field navigator. And everything. You know. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is also where you go when, in fact, you want to help us keep this on the air. A bit of a tough night last night. Okay. We had a $100 matching challenge on the table from our good friend Tom in the Bay Area, and we had $30 worth of responses to it. So, since we only got to the challenge about... with about an hour and 40 minutes to go in the program, that challenge is going to remain open for a little bit longer this evening in the hopes of garnering enough to justify the matching. In other words, $70. We try to raise $150 every evening, and we didn't do it last night. It would be nice if we could do it tonight, and if we can raise the $70, that means we will be done with April's fundraising and can get started on May tomorrow, which will be wonderful because, well, bills. Nah, who am I kidding? Look, Agnes's cabana boy is getting a little bit pushy, and the rent is due on the Maybach garage. And you know what? $36 million Learjets don't buy themselves. Right? Right. You know, I wish that was the case. I do. But it's not. Now, this is all just about keeping things on the air, and I hope we can. I hope in addition to $70 to meet Tom's matching challenge, we can come up with another, you know, 80 or so to make the $150 goal of any given evening, because we are a month-to-month operation. It's just the reality. You know, nope. I keep trying to find out. I don't know if some local dog or maybe a raccoon, this being rural West Virginia, or possibly a possum, is eating all those checks that are coming from George Soros, but I can't get him to answer the phone there at Left Wing Funding Conspiracy International Inc. Just can't. Thank you, Jeremy. Thank you very kindly. Loud and clear on TuneIn. It is good to know. So yeah, kick in via PayPal over at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com/contribute. Just get to the next screen. Never mind the pushy, intrusive, overly inquisitive fields of that thing. Just get to the next screen. If you prefer to operate via the U.S. mail, the U.S. Postal Service, which the right wing has not yet managed to completely shut down, then you can send checks or money orders made payable to The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, Beckley, WV 25801. Yes, indeed. And if you do that, send me a note, and I will let Boss Man Wayne know so that he won't have to wear his spider-proof gloves next time he goes to the mailbox. Lately, he's been opening the Horn Echo Chamber and just about getting the gloves chewed off his hands by the spider that lives in there. Mm-hmm. All right, so that's out of the way. Hey, wouldn't it be cool if I didn't have to mention that again for the rest of the evening? It is 7 past the hour, and this, of course, is Titanic Tuesday on the Horn. And we have some delightful entries for this particular evening. Remember, Titanic Tuesday is named for the 967-second level tier right-wing blatherer from over in Beckley who, for many, many mornings over the past several years, would get up and, in a stunning monotone, read the morning paper to his audience of knuckle-walkers and mouth-breathers and mouth-breathers and knuckle-walkers and knuckle-breathers and mouth-walkers and what have you, wing-nuts. And on one particular morning, one of the faithful called in and said, "Steve, why do you reckon it is that there's seashell fossils in the rocks of West Virginia? We ain't nowhere near the beach." And so it was that he then declared, "Well, listener, that's because of the movement of the Titanic plates." No word yet on the movement of the Titanic swirly straw. You had to know there was a Titanic swirly straw, didn't you? Yeah. So we celebrate right-wing attempts at intelligence, right-wing attempts at intellect, right-wing attempts at thought leadership on these here Titanic Tuesdays. All right, okay. An anonymous contribution has rolled in with the note that, all right, here's $25, but it has to go for Agnes's Cabana Boy. There are some things that we just, I understand. It's a matter of priorities. And he thanks you, and Agnes thanks you, and we all thank you because, well, when Agnes is happy, we're all happy. Wait, what do I hear? Yeah, I think I can hear. I just heard her hollering, "Oh, Cabana Boy!" Yes, because we also have a cabana here at the fabulous Kincaid Mansion here on the fabulous Kincaid Estate. Oh, we do. It's kind of a hillbilly cabana. It's made out of old wormy chestnut barn wood, but hell, a cabana is a cabana is a cabana, right? Just like a rose is a rose is a rose. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it is Titanic Tuesday on the Horn. Look out, iceberg dead ahead. I don't really know. Okay, they're not really a right wing organization. But they have all the charm of a zealous follower of Pol Pot combined with the social skills of the Tonton Macoute. Enter PETA. PETA is angry. PETA is always angry. If they don't have anything to be angry about, PETA is angry that they don't have anything to be angry about because PETA's job is to be angry. Mm-hmm. At the annual shindig that they have every year, and that's why it's annual, in Davos, Switzerland, Al Gore showed up with the musician Pharrell, Errol, P-H-A-R-R-E-L-L. He's the guy who gave us that song about how wonderful it is to live in a room without a roof and how it makes you happy. Still waiting for empirical evidence of same. Think I'll be waiting a while. Anyway, they announced that the worldwide music festival known as Live Earth will return this year. More than 100 artists will perform on 7 continents on June the 18th. Let's see, 7. North America, South America, Europe. I guess we're counting Europe and Asia as 2, although it's really one big wait a minute. North America, South America, Europe, Asia, Africa, Australia. We're gonna have music from Antarctica. Too cool. Anyway, they made the announcement and people said, "Oh, how nice!" And immediately PETA jumped out there and said, "They either care about stopping climate change or they're more interested in the appearance of caring while they decide the Earth is dying." No, it isn't. The Earth will be here after all the humans are gone. Lisa Lang, Senior Vice President of PETA, you goddamn Titanic fool. So PETA is hoping they immediately announce that they're putting their mock meat where their mouths are and making the Live Earth events vegan. Like I said, all the charm of a devoted act. maybe Pol Pot was a bit strong. All the charm of a devoted follower of Chairman Mao. Yeah. Yeah, the PETA is angry at Al Gore because he won't force everybody to eat tempeh. Which is fine, you know, I mean, that's not to say I don't like food porn. It's not to say I don't like vegan food. But by the same token, there's something just more than a little bit creepy about Lisa Lang over at PETA declaring that everyone, I guess she's going to make, I guess she wants to make vegans out of, say, the Inuit people. That ought to be enjoyable. Because now I get the point that she's upset about industrial meat production, because there is a significant nexus between things like CAFOs and global climate change. I mean, it's nowhere near, say, the combustion of coal or natural gas or oil or anything, but, I mean, all those animals, you know, they fart, and there's a lot of methane involved, which is not good for the atmosphere, not good for the climate. But her totalitarian approach is off-putting. And without sounding geezery, she gives the PETA people, who really are yucky, and I know a lot of people who, for instance, care a great deal about animals, who find PETA yucky. PETA has been busted in the past for casually cruising through neighborhoods and rounding up not stray animals, but people's beloved household pet family members and putting them in their rolling euthanasia vans. They have those, PETA does. They really do. And just kind of killing them to save them. I don't know, there's something really soylent green as people about PETA, but I thought I'd give them pride of place because on Titanic Tuesday, because we don't get their Titanic intellect very often. But don't you be planning on going to no live Earth concerts and eating no corn dog like what they has at the Iowa State Fair. Or for God's sakes, at least don't let them photograph you. Marcus Bachman learned that the hard way. I shouldn't say that. Meanwhile, there's other out there for us. Oh, by the way, a quick program note because I neglected to mention it 10 minutes ago. No program on Friday. It is May 1st is our 22nd wedding anniversary, Agnes and me. And I'm sorry, we're not bringing the Cabana Boy with us. I'm just going to have to put my foot down. But I will not be on the air Friday evening for Friday on the Front Porch. I don't miss many of them, but this one I have to. Because I want to. And I don't do that very often. So I don't know. We'll go and hang out and look at everything blooming along the New River Gorge or just go for a walk somewhere or something. But you know, spend that time together celebrating the 22 years we've been together. So if anybody wants to do a Thorn in the Front Porch Thursday, well, get hold of Sparky over on Skype or tell him in the chat room and let him know. So next up, this is absolutely a delightful story. It's the anatomy of a smear. The only thing being that whereas usually right-wing smears have to be deconstructed, sort of reverse-engineered so that you can see all the players, this smear was deliberately done and deliberately outed. Now, most everybody by now has seen photographs of Harry Reid since his accident in January. He was working out with a resistance band, and I did some physical therapy, so I know what those are. But the resistance band snapped and sent Harry Reid flying into some cabinets. And he landed face first. And he broke several bones in his face. And in fact, he may lose the sight in his right eye. The story is over at Think Progress, and it's delightful reading. Now, you remember, in the wildly paranoid right wing in America, the greatest country in the world on earth today ever. In the wildly paranoid right wing in America, nothing is ever as it seems. You may, for instance, recall Jerry Falwell's hustling back before he became the eternal resident of the barbecue spit in hell, attended by Satan's little minions. He was hustling the Clinton body count, alleging that the Clintons were killers, I tell you, killers! And, of course, the flotsam and jetsam of the right wing, filthy creatures like Flush Flimball, picked up and ran with it. You may recall all the conspiracy tales about the MENA airport. And so the right wing is always open for a good conspiracy. Remember when Anthrax Coulter said that Hillary Clinton decorated the White House Christmas tree with condoms because they love abortion and who knows? It's Ann Coulter, you know? So there's a history there. Well, Larry Pfeiffer is a motivational speaker and life coach in Las Vegas. And when the news broke that Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid of Nevada had been injured, he just had an idea that he could punk some right-wingers. This he then did, getting hold of the delightfully named John Hindraker over at the Powerline blog. Larry Pfeiffer called himself Easton Elliott. Because that is such a butch right-wing name. Easton Elliott, defender of freedom. Got a ring to it, doesn't it? So what he was going to do is he was going to take John Hindraker to task for his suggestion. And I don't know, we may have even mentioned this on the program. His suggestion, John Hindraker's, that apparently Harry Reid had run afoul of the mob. When a guy shows up at a Las Vegas emergency room on New Year's Day with severe facial injuries and broken ribs and gives as an explanation the functional equivalent of I walked into a doorknob, it isn't hard to guess that he ran afoul of mobsters. But the national press is... He didn't call him the liberal media. He's slacking. The national press has studiously averted its eyes from Reed's condition and has refused to investigate the cause of his injuries. To my knowledge, every Washington reporter has at least pretended to believe Reed's story. Okay? I mean, this is just chewy and delicious. Now, understand that the delightfully named John Hindraker just made that shit up out of whole cloth. Not even one molecule, not one iota, not one subatomic particle of evidence supported his claim. So when Easton Elliott got hold of John Hindraker, well, Larry Pfeiffer said, I made up the story off the cuff. It was so outrageous, I thought there was no way that Hindraker would run with it. But he did. And the what he did was Larry Pfeiffer, in the guise of Easton Elliott, told Hindraker that he had inside information that Harry Reid had been beaten up, not by the mob, but by his brother Larry. So Hindraker, who has, I guess, the contact information for Flush Flimball, the oxymoron, arranged for Easton Elliott, American truth teller, to be interviewed by Flush Limbaugh. And every time Limbaugh asked for verification, Pfeiffer Elliott just refused. Nonetheless, even though there was no verification, even though there was no background, even though there was no evidence to support the truth of it, the right wing, because it desperately wanted to believe this, ran with it. Like they had recovered a fumble. So, the delightfully named John Hindraker ran with it. Someone attacked Harry Reid on New Year's Eve or New Year's Day. That much seems clear from photographs and from the nature of his injuries. The inferences that Easton Elliott draws seem reasonable. So, the delightfully named John Hindraker has a gig filling in when Laura Ingraham can't sober up enough to get behind the microphone. And so he had Easton Elliott on the show. And then Flush Flimball repeated the beaten up by his brother story to the strange little creatures who listened to that program. Other media outlets of the right wing, and I mean we do lose that we do use that term loosely, went wild with the story. The people over at that website that rhymes with light and fart went with the story. On the other hand, the Huffington Post wouldn't go because he couldn't provide corroboration. Hindraker, delightfully named though he is, won't quite admit that he got had.
I did check him out to the extent reasonably possible.
Which is to say, not at all. And here's the punchline. Here's the best part. Larry Pfeiffer says, I don't even know Harry Reid. I'm not political. I don't even vote. But hey, journalism is supposed to uplift society in a moral way, not turn it to shit. Which is exactly what Rush Limbaugh and the delightfully named John Hindraker and those people over at the website that rhymes with light and fart and that other website that rhymes with gaze, and you know the sludge report, and all they traffic in is filth. And for their trouble, they got proven to be the sleaze merchants that they are. Yeah, see, if I was the delightfully named John Hindraker, I think I would have started, with beaten up by his brother Larry. Because maybe the first question would have been, does he have another brother named Daryl and another brother named Daryl? Click. It's Titanic Tuesday. And see, even when they see the iceberg, the John Hindrakers and Flush Flimballs holler down that tube to the engine room, all ahead full, my friends! Where's my cigar box full of pills? I chew them up for the refreshing burst of flavor. Yeah. But of course, while we have any number of stories, you know, little small fry stories like the two I've just mentioned, two dominate the headlines today. And, of course, that is the ongoing civil unrest. In Baltimore. And a few miles to the west, the arguments today regarding whether or not the Constitution applies to gay people who would like to avail themselves of the vast raft of legal rights that appertain unto married people under the government of this country. Because it's Titanic Tuesday, let's start in Baltimore with the usual suspects. First of all, you may recall yesterday evening references made to the fact that people were falling for an assertion by the Baltimore police that the Crips and the Bloods and other gangs have declared a truce in order to come together and kill policemen. And we sort of noted that that was probably bullshit right then and there. Yeah? Yeah. Well, guess what? It was exactly that. Bullshit. WBAL-TV was the one, the outfit, the organization that put paid to that dirty little bit of propaganda. Because a very white reporter lady had a perfectly civil conversation with some of those Negro gang members. Let's check out a little bit of the audio from WBAL.
Share something with you. You know, throughout the night, I've had a number of young people say to me and stop me and say, you really need to talk to us and you really need to get our voice heard. And I said, you are absolutely right. And so we have a portion of an interview we did with some of the gang members who were attending the meeting tonight with church leaders. And here's some of what they had to say. Here's your opportunity. Tell me what's going on.
Now, we want to tell the people of the city right now, of Baltimore City, that the image that they're trying to portray of the gangs in Baltimore, the BGF, the Bloods, the Crips, we did not make that truce to harm cops. We did not come together against the cops. We're not about to allow y'all to paint this picture of us. We got soldiers out here right now. We dirty. You know, we dirty. They threw bombs at us for trying to stop what's going on right now. Y'all not about to do that to us.
So your game plan tonight has been to stop the violence.
To stop what's going on. That's all we're trying to do. We want justice for Freddie Gray. We believe in that.
What do you think when you see this happening in the streets? Businesses looted, cars on fire, police injured.
It just makes us look bad. It makes us look real bad. And it's backing up what they're saying about us. They're saying we animals and we acting like savages out here. But I also agree with what's... I don't agree with what's going on, but I understand what's going on. You know what I'm saying? I understand why people are mad. But we got to handle things another way.
What do you think?
Me, I basically think the same thing. I mean, we've been out here all day trying to prevent people from breaking the stores. They hit us with a bomb. They burnt my shirt. They ripped it. And we were still standing right there as a whole. They heard it, but we came right back there, hold hands together. And we marched together. Down here, we still holding strong, and we just want them to stop hurting us so we can just live our life and keep going. We trying to help them, and like we helping us. Without them doing that, it's just going to make everybody angry. We don't want to be angry. So we, as a whole community, we make everybody, you know, calm everybody down because they can't calm to us because they done already hurt a lot of people, killed a lot of people for no apparent reason.
What group are you in? What,
what group is this?
This is the Bloods right here. This Bloods. We got the Pyrus over here, and we got Bloods over here. We stand as one, though. We're one right now.
It's Black Men United.
Our goal
Saturday. The pictures that went viral
we're not
Saturday.
Not Blood or BGF. We are Black Men, and we are united. Right. And we're not going to stop. No matter if y'all even keep on trying to say we out here trying to shoot police, we're not trying to shoot police. We're not going to let that stop us from doing what we already originally planned to do.
So people who are watching right now, what do you want to say to them? How do you want to explain what is happening tonight?
Basically, stop believing everything you hear in the media. If you were not at that protest on the day that we protested for Freddie, you don't know what actually happened. They didn't tell y'all that when we walked past the eateries downtown that people threw beers at us. People called us names. You know, everything. To be blunt, they called us those things. So the protest was agitated, you know.
So you guys feel that you're getting the blame, correct,
yes,
for
exactly.
What's
yes,
happening?
Ma'am.
And
a lot
you're
of the blame.
Saying that
yes, ma'am.
That as member of the Bloods.
Just because we black and we have flags on, they assume that we're going to hurt somebody or do this or go and bring the next person down. And most of us, as us older people, we bring everybody closer, make sure they got jobs, go to school on time and all that. But they just making it seem like, oh, he's black, he got a flag on, he's doing the wrong thing. And we not doing the wrong thing. Like me, I just came home, and I'm trying to do any and everything to prevent the going back home. You know what I'm saying? I got locked up for helping a female out downtown on Baltimore Street. Her beef, I was beaten up, and I stopped it. I tried to prevent it. I used self-defense, even though there's no self-defense law in there. But I still, right now, they locked me up just because I'm me. I'm a black male, a flag.
The main thing is they've been portraying us in this way for so long. And where we are in our environment, a lot of the neighborhoods, a lot of the so-called gang members and gang bangers, that's where they come from or where they are. The point that we're trying to get across is that we are of a different faction. And what that's going to do is it start to show people in the community that we can come together as a unit and be unified and be peaceful. It was so much stuff that was going on Saturday that got portrayed in the wrong direction or in the wrong light that for some reason, who knows, right? Why they won't paint this picture in a positive way. Like when a group of 30 Bloods walks up on a group of 30 Crips and everybody salutes and shakes hands and hugs and starts to take pictures, but then the pictures that they take, they say, oh no, now they're uniting to kill cops. Like they won't tell you the good side of what we're really, really doing in these communities. Like while we out here at this church tonight.
And let's get one thing understood. Although our cause is righteous, we cannot control every person. Just because a person is a member of the Bloods or Crips, we can't control every gang in the city and say, stop this. At the end of the day, everybody has their own mind. But when we were downtown protesting, I'm going to estimate that we were about 30 people strong. Out of all the thousands of people that were down there, you mean to tell me that you guys are pointing a finger at us because we had colors on? No, we're not. We can't have that. That's not what we stand for, and that's not what we're standing for today. Justice for Freddie Gray.
Thank you.
Just got an email a minute ago from Steve in New York City. Subject line, gangs. Steve says, can't be true, Bob. Doesn't fit the narrative. Which is exactly what I was thinking. Remember Luther the Anger Translator's line on Fox Saturday night regarding Fox at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, where he said, yeah, and Fox saying some crazy stuff to scare the old white people. Hello? What did I say last night? You can't tell the truth to America without putting a little joke in front of it. You can't give America the bitter draft without a spoonful of sugar. This is that. And this, you know, this is a movie we've been to before. Granted, I was a child and not there at the time that it was happening. But was the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense not equally smeared? Yes, why, yes, as a matter of fact, it was. There have been a lot of the shibboleths of the hate-filled right wing in this country who have been present. There were members of the Nation of Islam who were trying to keep order and urging peace in Baltimore. But none of that matters. None of that matters. Because what will be presented by the for-profit media is what the for-profit media wants the country to think. And the for-profit media, apparently, I don't fully understand it, have a vested interest in portraying people of color in this country as simply being out-of-control savages. Maybe it makes them easier to kill. But probably the most brilliant thing that I have read regarding any of this came from Ta-Nehisi Coates over at The Atlantic, theatlantic.com, a piece called Nonviolence as Compliance. And this is the takeaway paragraph. When nonviolence is preached as an attempt to evade the repercussions of police brutality, it betrays itself. When nonviolence begins halfway through the war with the aggressor calling time out, it exposes itself as a ruse. When nonviolence is preached by the representatives of the state, while the state doles out heaps of violence to its citizens, it reveals itself to be a con. And none of this can mean that rioting or violence is correct or wise any more than a forest fire can be correct or wise. Wisdom isn't the point tonight. Disrespect is. In this case, disrespect for the hollow law and failed order that so regularly disrespects the community. And every word of that paragraph is absolutely true. Nonviolence works as an operating principle when that's what it is going in. When you know that you're going to be beaten and you engage in civil disobedience anyway. It's a different story altogether when people respond to violence and the power structure then hollers, "Hey, hey, what about Dr. King? What about nonviolence?" That is not the same thing. But this is just a little bitty radio program that hangs on from month to month. And we don't have quite the punch of a professional for-profit media journalist like Hauptmann Wolf Blitzer. Of the Royal Chicken Noodle Brigade. Being an old white guy, Wolf Blitzer sees everything through the lens of white power, white privilege, and is blind to virtually every other consideration. So, over at Chicken Noodle News, when Hauptmann Wolf Blitzer decided to interview DeRay McKesson in Baltimore, you knew how it was going to be. I don't know if she's out there this evening, but before I even say what I'm about to say, I know that Sandra knows exactly what I'm thinking. Take it away, Wolf Blitzer.
You simply get chills every time you see these poor individuals. As Jack Cafferty just pointed out, so tragically, so many of these people, almost all of them that we see, are so poor and they are so black, and this is going to raise lots of questions for people who are watching this story unfold.
That's right, Wolf. So poor, so black. That should just be his nickname. Instead of doing the cheesy accent and help von Blitzer, no, we should just call him Wolf So Poor, So Black Blitzer. But that's how he, millionaire that he is, member of the 1% that he is, that's how Wolf Blitzer views Wolf Blitzer's world. And that's why this interview, remember when he was interviewing the, he interviewed the tornado victim in Oklahoma and said, yeah, but you have to thank God, don't you? No, not really, I'm an atheist. Yeah, but... I mean, if it wasn't so serious, it would be funny. And maybe... Even though it is so serious when it comes to people like Wolf, So Poor, So Black Blitzer, it's still funny. Well, why prolong the suspense? Here then, respected for-profit media journalist, guardian of the Fourth Estate, State. Wolf, So Poor, So Black Blitzer, trying to control the narrative in Baltimore and trying desperately to get people focused on those wild-eyed, savage Negroes!
I want to bring in DeRay McKesson. He's a community activist who we first met in Ferguson, Missouri. He's now in Baltimore as part of a peaceful protest. DeRay, thanks very much for joining us. What's your plan today? What's your mission in Baltimore?
You know, we're here supporting the protesters on the ground and continuing the movement. You know, there's been a lot of positive demonstrations over the past couple months here in Baltimore and across the country because the police have continued to kill people. And tonight will be another night where people come out into the streets to confront a system that is corrupt.
But you want peaceful protest, right?
Yes, for sure. Yep. And remember, the people that have been violent since August have been the police. We think about the 300 people that have been killed this year alone, like that is violence. There's been property damage here that's been really unfortunate over the past couple for a day or so here. But remember, there have been many days of peaceful protests here in Baltimore City and in places all around the country.
But at least 15 police officers have been hurt, 200 arrests, 144 vehicle fires. These are statistics local police have put out, 15 structure fires. There's no excuse for that kind of violence, right?
Yeah, and there's no excuse for the 7 people that the Baltimore City Police Department has killed in the past year either, right?
God love you, DeRay. You're talking to the wrong guy if you're asking somebody to give a damn about police violence. Old Wolf, So Poor, So Black Blitzer, he's part of the white power structure. And he's not going to give one damned inch of ground. Mm-mm. I mean, you can hear it's an unfair contest. Wolf is coming to an intellectual battle. With, as Flush Limbaugh describes it, half his brain tied behind his back. and that apparently it was the good half.
Not making comparisons. Obviously, we don't want anybody.
Yeah, Wolf, you are making comparisons. See, DeRay's now got him on the defensive. It's down goes Frazier. Down goes Frazier. Although Wolf is no Frazier.
15 structure fires. There's no excuse for that kind of violence, right?
Actually, there is. There is. I mean, was there an excuse? Because Wolf was right there along with everybody else, it seems like, in the for-profit media, cheerleading our nasty little war of aggression, war of choice, in Iraq back in 2003 and 4 and 5 and 6 and 7 and 8. He was right there. Now, there was more than any 15 structures damaged in that war that we started against them, but I don't recall a single blessed moment when Wolf, so poor, so black, Blitzer, did a stand-up saying, there is no excuse for that kind of violence. When in fact, there was less excuse for the entirety of a war in Iraq than for anything that has happened in Baltimore. Baltimore is, in point of fact, chickens coming home to roost. Now, the right wing crucified Ward Churchill for that phrase a few years back, figuratively. If they could have done so literally, I am sure they would have. It would have made for great television. But it remains a reality. There's stuff going on here that has its roots 400 years ago. Really? 400 years. But Wolf, so poor, so black, Blitzer, by God, he's got a handle on it. He knows where the fault lies. He knows who's responsible. Doesn't he? Or does? I love that those leading questions from for-profit media millionaire journalists that end in right. It's called leading the witness, Wolf. And if you have to do that, it's pretty obvious you're on the losing end of the question.
15 police officers have been hurt, 200 arrests, 144 vehicle fires. These are statistics local police have put out, 15 structure fires. There's no excuse for that kind of violence, right?
Yeah, and there's no excuse for the 7 people that the Baltimore City Police Department has killed in the past year either, right?
We're not making comparisons. Obviously, we don't want to...
Actually, he was, but let's not interrupt.
Anybody hurt, but I just want to hear you say that there should be peaceful protests, not violent protests.
I want to hear you say that you Negroes should be peaceful and never ever get upset, even though the police behave like thugs. That's what I want to hear you say. I want to hear you say that you won't complain even if they start knocking down doors and lynching you people in the dark and still of the night. That's what I want to hear you say, for I am Wolf, so poor, so black, Blitzer.
In the tradition of Dr. Martin Luther King.
Oh, boy. Oh. Whoa, Nelly. Done hauled out the corpse of Dr. King to give him a good flogging. I wonder if Wolf even vaguely understands the idea of oppression, or if oppression to Wolf Blitzer is being brought a cup of coffee that is not sufficiently hot. Okay, we're going to go back. We're going to go back. So, because I want to get the whole flogging of Dr. King's dead body thing done.
We don't want anybody hurt, but I just want to hear there should be peaceful protests, not violent protests, in the tradition of Dr. Martin Luther King.
There should be peaceful protests, and I don't have to condone it to understand it, right? That the pain that people feel is real, and you are making a comparison. You are suggesting this idea that broken windows are worse than broken spines, right? And what we know to be true is that the police are killing people everywhere. They're killing people here. Six police officers were involved in the killing of Freddie Gray, and we're looking for justice there. And that's real, right? That, like, the violence that the police have been inflicting on communities of color has been sustained and deep.
But you agree, I assume, with President Obama.
Wait. Did he even hear what DeRay McKesson said? His follow-up question begins with, but. But is disjunctive. But is contrapuntal, is it not? And I love the, I love the, but you're a Negro. You must certainly agree with your Negro president. Honest to God, if this thing had lasted much longer than it did, he would have been, Wolf would have, Wolf so poor, so black blitzer, would have wound up saying, now I have some black friends. I spoke just today with my black friend Don Lemon, and Don Lemon says, all right, we'll go back.
And that's real, right? That, like, the violence that the police have been inflicting on communities of color has been sustained and deep.
Got that? The violence the police have been inflicting on communities of color has been sustained and deep. That's a sentence. Subject, verb, predicate. There was no question mark. There was nothing but that statement. And yet, Wolf, so poor, so black blitzer, responds.
But you agree, I assume, with President Obama, who just said a few moments ago, there's no excuse for the violence that erupted yesterday. There's no excuse for the stealing. No excuse for the arson. You agree with the president?
Well, before we find out, yes, I heard that clip as well. There was a state visit in the Rose Garden involving the Prime Minister of Japan, Shinzo Abe, and Barack Obama addressed this issue. He said a lot of things. He said that this isn't just something that just happened, that there are problems that we have ignored in this country for far too long. But yes, he did say there is no excuse for this. And I think we can do some parsing, maybe even some hair splitting. To wit, excuse is a loaded word. Because obviously, if you're making excuses for the property damage, well, you must approve of it. In old and more classical times, it would have been thought of as an apologia, an apology. We understand apology now to mean an expression of regret. An apologia in the classical sense is a defense of, an explanation of, complete with tacit approval of the subject. But okay, let's give President Obama the benefit of the doubt that there's no excuse. What if there doesn't need to be one? What if a pattern and practice of human rights abuses reaches a critical mass in which it becomes intolerable? What if all the peaceful protests, What if all the kumbaya singing and all the hand-holding for a generation, ever since they stuck Dr. King in the dirt, has come to nothing? What then? Is what comes after something that needs an excuse? Or is it something that needs to be very patiently and slowly explained, as though to someone of limited intellectual capacity? What if it needs to be explained to white privilege America? What about that? In that case, you say, no, there is no excuse, or no excuse need be offered. But never mind me. Let's hear how DeRay McKesson handed Wolf So Poor So Black Blitzer his butt.
True is that the police are killing people everywhere. They're killing people here. Six police officers were involved in the killing of Freddie Gray, and we're looking for justice there. And that's real, right? So, like, the violence that the police have been inflicting on communities of color has been sustained and deep.
But you agree, I assume, with President Obama, who just said a few moments ago, there's no excuse for the violence that erupted yesterday. There's no excuse for the stealing. No excuse for the arson. You agree with the president?
What I agree with is that I advocate people to peacefully protest. I also know that pain manifests in different ways, and I don't have to condone it to understand it. People are grieving and people are mourning. And I would advocate personally for people to do it in ways that you are calling peacefully. But again, I also know that Freddie Gray will never be back and that those windows will be.
Whoa. I think Wolf just got taken into the cheap seats. I mean, DeRay McKesson just parked that one. Freddie Gray will never be back. Those windows will be. Eat it, Wolf. Own it.
The president also said, President.
Yeah, Wolf knew he got owned too.
In ways that you are calling peacefully, but again, I also know that Freddie Gray will never be back, and that those windows will be.
You wonder if the whole time that this is going on in his in the thin gray settlings between his ears that pass for brains, you wonder if Wolf So Poor So Black is hearing nothing but, where are the white women at? Because I think that's pretty much all his internal translator is able to emit.
The president also said, President Obama, he said the violence, he said, distracted from the peaceful protests and distracted from the mourning that the family of Freddie Gray was seeking yesterday. Your reaction to that?
You know, we're distracted from progress is when city officials get on TV and call black people in pain thugs, right? That's a distraction. So, I think that the unrest, the uprising, whatever you call it, is again a cry for justice here and a cry for justice across the country, because the police continue to terrorize people. And again, the terrorizing is actually deadly. Broken windows are not broken spines. People are in pain. So I think that the president, I hope that he understands the conditions that created the unrest and that continue the unrest, not only here in Baltimore, but across the country, because Freddie Gray will never see another day, and neither will Tamir or Ayanna or Mike Brown.
I don't think we need to go to the judges' cards on this one. This is by knockout. And Wolf So Poor So Black Blitzer is on the canvas, and DeRay McKesson is standing over him. Oh my, that's a bit of a violent metaphor, isn't it? You know who DeRay McKesson sounds like? He's identified on screen as DeRay McKesson, community organizer. He sounds like a leader. He sounds like someone who can actually give voice and reality to the oppression. And maybe make real for an insulated, comfortable white America, deeply privileged, what it feels like to always be a target. Not the phony persecution complex of the American right wing, and especially the religion industry, but to really walk around every blessed day with a target on. We're learning things, once again, that we really wish we didn't have to learn. We're learning about how, in Baltimore, if the police do not like you, and the odds of not being liked by the police go up exponentially based on the darkness of one's skin, you might just get what's called, what they euphemistically refer to as a rough ride. That's where they handcuff you and throw you unrestrained into the back of the paddy wagon and then drive very erratically around the city, sharp turns, swerves, hard stops, rapid accelerations, and you get tossed around in the back of the wagon rather like a like a rag doll with its sawdust cut. Such rough rides have already resulted in actionable offenses. That's one of the things that this community knew before Freddie Gray was ever murdered . By the way, the cops are lawyered up. At least one of the six cops is lawyered up and has refused to give any sort of a statement, even though he is obliged by contract to do so. If you have seen the video, and I'm sure you have by now, you know that Freddie Gray was screaming in agony by the time they threw him into the van before they gave him that ride. And, of course, rough rides appear nowhere in the approved policies and procedures of the Baltimore City Police Department. Of course not. And, of course, rough rides will be tolerated and tacitly approved of as long as the blue wall of silence is maintained. Anybody out there taking bets on whether or not there's even an indictment in this case? Because if I had $5 in my pocket, I wouldn't waste it on a wager such as that. But paranoid, scared half-to-death white America, somehow or another, has got to have its eyes opened to the reality of a very different America that exists alongside their own. There's an America that exists outside the lily-white gated communities of the 1%. It's the America that is lived in day to day by the people who come and support and carry those 1%ers on their backs every day. But for so long as we fail to comprehend, fail to even try to understand this America, We only guarantee that it will be perpetuated. There are, you know, there are very real world solutions to a lot of this. Open the doors of education. Now understand, on a national level, outside this wee little radio program, this is not a conversation that's going to be had. If some member of Congress were to dare to raise an issue like this, there would be full-on hissies had by all the terrified teabagger white people in the Congress. But what if? What if? And I'm going to say the word here. Reparations. What if reparations took the form of a generation of young Americans of color who had the ivy-covered doors of the institutions of higher learning flung open to them so that they could go and pursue an education? The young men that you heard speaking on the WBAL audio that I shared a little bit ago, those are not young men incapable of learning. Those are not savages. Those are not animals. Those are people getting by as best they can in a situation, in a world that doesn't even want them. What if? Just what if? They could go to school. Go to college. And in the midst of this, there's all of this talk we've had. We need more community colleges teaching more vocational skills. Bullshit. If we were really committed to that kind of thing, you know who teaches vocational skills better than anybody else in this country? Unions. What if union apprenticeship programs were open far and wide to young people of color and young poor people? What if there was no limit on the amount of people they could take into those programs? The only entrance requirement being a real and dedicated desire to learn. What if young people of color who wanted to learn all the what is art, what is beauty, what is truth stuff of the liberal arts had that available to them? And had it available to them knowing at the same time that they would not have to come out absolutely buried in debt so that they would have to then sell themselves to whom, whatever corporation would hire them, so that they could maintain their student loan payments. What if instead people were able to return to their own communities and revitalize them? And not just revitalize them, make every tiny hamlet, every small town in America, that shining city on a hill. You know, a couple of months back, Dr. Bill spent a considerable amount of time on the Ursula K. Le Guin short story, The People Who Walk Away from Amelos. What if this country did not have to have that child in the closet that Ursula K. Le Guin writes about? Because, see, we do have the child in the closet. But it's not a child. It is an entire population of this country. Because you see, if we wanted it, we could have it. And I suppose I should be careful with the use of the word we. I want it. You want it. We want an America that can be a light unto the nations. But there is a boatload of folks, maybe it's a fairly small boat, that don't. Because, see, for all the breathless for-profit media reportage that attends one of these moments, there's a lot of people that are okay with it. There are a lot of people who profit by it. There are a lot of people whose ways of life cannot be maintained outside of this. And that is as it ever was for 400 years on this continent. It is the origins of racism in America. It is the down-to-the-ground essence of oppression. And yes, enslavement. For some reason or another, last night, as I prepared to attempt to sleep, I couldn't escape history. And I thought, and I didn't like myself for thinking it, but I thought about John Brown. And I thought about the final words of John Brown. Right before the military gang commanded by old Marse Bobby Lee took him to the scaffold, John Brown sat and wrote a few final thoughts. It was the second day of December 1859. And he said, I am now quite certain that the crimes of this guilty land will never be purged away but with blood. I had, as I now think, vainly flattered myself that without very much bloodshed, it might be done. And like so much of history, I was about to say American history, but it's like so much of history, but in this case, American history. We look at what he said and we realize that a little over a year and a half later, armies would be marching against each other at places like Philippi, Virginia, which is now West Virginia, at places like Bull Run, at places like Shiloh. And that all the bloodshed that would attend the Civil War was what he was talking about. But John Brown didn't know there was a Civil War coming. It was a year and a half away. Lincoln, this is the Buchanan administration, not the Lincoln administration in Washington. John Brown had a far more vast vision of this country. When he wrote "The Crimes of This Guilty Land," he wasn't simply writing about the slaveholding South. Because the effects of slavery were very real in the North. The textile mills that turned Southern slave-grown, slave-picked cotton into merchantable goods We're in New England. Everybody had their feet standing in innocent blood. And the capital made out of that is still rattling around in the vaults today. At least in the aftermath of the Second World War, we made some sort of an effort to sort out who profited by those horrors. Have we ever done that in the United States? At least in the aftermath of the fall of apartheid in South Africa, they had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission in which they came together and talked about those horrors openly and honestly. Have we ever done that in this country? No. And for as long as we don't, there will be no solution. It doesn't matter if it was a white man or a black man standing in the Rose Garden today saying, "Well, there is no excuse." Because that's the response of power. What did anybody expect him to say? Did they think that whole Luther the Anger Translator bit was for real? Hell, that was an attempt to talk about climate change. You think we're going to have a conversation, an open, honest conversation, led by the President of the United States about race, when Fox News is sitting there waiting to pounce?
Yeah, this is a Fox News breaking alert. Be afraid, white America. Be very afraid.
But the crimes of this guilty land have never been purged. Ever. And the question is, will they ever? We could. We really, really could. We could make good on the promises of emancipation, but to this day, we have not. I'm sitting here in the studio, and I'm holding my hands right now. A photograph. It is an old, shiny, you can almost see the sheen of the silver nitrate in it, 8x10, black and white, glossy photograph. In the lower right-hand corner, it says simply, Oak Hill, 1924. There is a milling crowd of women in overcoats and those little round domed hats with flowers on them that were all the fashion back then. There is a milling crowd of men in haberdashery and overcoats. It must have been the cool of the year. I'd say maybe autumn. They're not dressed for the 4th of July. And there's hundreds of people there. In street clothes. But there are also hundreds of men. In white robes. With pointed hoods. Pulled over their heads and over their faces. Three crosses burn in the night. A great panel of, I don't know, whatever it was they used for flash photography, because this was shot at a distance, burns and sends smoke into the sky. A number of the men in white robes with pointy hats covering their faces are formed into the shape of the cross upon which was crucified their Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. A few of the men are on horseback. an entire ring of Klansmen surrounds the White Cross, or the White Cross and the burning crosses. At least five hold American flags at salute. And one of those men, in one of those robes, is my grandfather Kincaid. He would have been all of 30 years old at the time. Two of his babies would have been born. The third, my mother, would not be born until the spring of the following year. And so while I live in rural America, and while I yet know what overt racism is, because all I have to do is drive downtown after the program, and I can hear a bunch of hateful old men, they won't even look around to see who's listening, to see if anybody of color is within earshot before they start hurling that word around and telling their that word Obama jokes. I recognize that I'm part of it. I'm not responsible for the sins of my grandfather or of any of my progeny. I'm responsible only for myself and arguably for the conduct of my children. But even that, not as much as one might hope. Children turn out to be adults, don't they? But to pretend that the hundreds of people in this photograph, it's to pretend that they didn't have children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. This is roughly 60 years after the end of the Civil War. 1924, and culturally it is worth noting that it is also during the heyday of an absolute paroxysm of Republican excess in the United States. And I had no hand in that, but I have a hand, and you have a hand, in the present and future of this country. I can't change, the past cannot be changed, the future is unborn, and the present is all we have to work with. But the present in which we live in the United States of America is an ugly and a brutal one, and it only becomes more so for as long as we pretend that it isn't. So the question is, beyond talking about it, beyond bemoaning it, beyond waiting for Wolf So Poor So Black Blitzer to decry property violence, but somehow not at the same time be able to decry extrajudicial police lynchings of young black men. Beyond all that, what can we do? What do the people of Baltimore, of Ferguson, people in Detroit horrified by a police lynching caught on tape? And let's understand that that's what they are. They are lynchings. This is outsourcing. The members of the community used to run around in their little in their nasty ass white robes in the middle of the night. But that became socially unacceptable, so we outsourced it to the police and made it possible for the police to do it instead. I give you the words of Woodrow Wilson. This actually appears in the screens of D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation, once upon a time the most popular film ever made. Woodrow Wilson said, "The white men were roused by a mere instinct of self-preservation until at last there had sprung into existence a great Ku Klux Klan, a veritable empire of the South, to protect the Southern country." That's our past. What will its impact be upon our future? I don't know. I will say only this. If, as I fear, as soon as the fires are put out, the for-profit media all fly away, it'll just be another thing that we in the United States of amnesia forget. Ray wrote in a little bit ago and said, the minute it becomes a peaceful protest, the media is going home. I keep asking outraged white people, what would you do? No good answers yet. No good answers yet. The question is, will there be any good answers ever? Not unless we are demanding of them. And that demand must come from all of the 99%. Not just the part of the 99% who are periodically lynched by the police. This seems to have turned into rather of an epic filibuster. Well, I'm interested to hear your thoughts. And we've also got the other side of the coin to deal with, that which was going on. It's not the other side of the coin, it's a different coin. Another manifestation of the seemingly endless capacity of the right wing for bigotry in the United States. We've got that to deal with. I want to thank Dan, and I want to thank Glenn, and Texas T. And a contributor who wishes to remain anonymous. Because of you, we have finished up on our good friend Tom's challenge for the end of April. Thank you very kindly. A little bit more, and we will have actually reached the fundraising goal for this evening. A little bit more beyond that, you know, 115 or so, and we will have reached the fundraising goal for yesterday and today. Thank you all very kindly. The marvelously coherent Diane in Kansastan says, Wolf Blitzer should slink away and stop talking. Devoutly to be wished. Tim from L.A. with a note says, there's this meme on Facebook of white kids rioting after the Kentucky game, and there were no riot police. These kids were burning garbage cars, overturned media vans, and so on, and not one SS officer went bashing their heads in. One thing I noticed, though, and it wasn't on the MSM, when the Occupy movement was in full force, middle-class white kids were getting their asses kicked by the cops, but I don't remember seeing it on ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, or CNN. At Baltimore, when the uprising happens, these protesters are called thugs, troublemakers, and so on. It got so bad that the Baltimore PD said that when the Crips and Bloods were uniting to protest the police violence, every law enforcement in the U.S. was on high alert, including the LAPD, because both gangs wanted to kill all the cops. Then I heard that the LAPD stopped the tactical alert because they found out that it was not true. Idiotic reactions only lead to more dead people, and folks like Limp Balls and Shamity thrive off of all of this. That is, until the protest happens in their neighborhood. It's going to get worse, and I wonder what side people will pick to stand. I know the Hornedanistas and Maloyalists will know where to go, and we will stand on the side of the people. Well, of course, Tim, you got to remember, when white kids do that, they're just being high-spirited. They're just full of piss and vinegar. Right? Yeah. So let's take a little break and come back to your calls, your ideas, your thoughts, and, yes, perhaps a little discussion of the marriage equality oral arguments in the Supreme Court today. Oddly enough, a ranting religious maniac was removed from the Supreme Court during oral arguments today. And yet, somehow or another, they let Antonin Scalia stay. Go figure. This is listener-supported conversation radio. You are the only reason this radio network continues to exist. This is the Horn, and you are the Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
It's Tuesday, April 28, 2015.
As more and more people are fleeing their homes to set up camp outside, you can see how they're living in temporary accommodation, using anything they can to find some kind of protection.
Devastation in Nepal after massive earthquake. March 2015, the hottest March on record. Sardines crash in the Pacific, plus...
They're seeing hotter temperatures, they're seeing longer drought. They're seeing the impact of the changing climate.
Fighting climate change with the power of poo.
All of those fights and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
California is bone dry. It looked like a trailer for the new Mad Max movie up in there.
Yep, it do. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, we're out here in California, out here in Los Angeles. It do look like a Mad Max movie. It is bone dry at this time, and we're in, where are we, April at this point, and it's already hitting 90 degrees again. It's unbelievable what's going on, and there seems to be no relief in sight.
And it's not your imagination, but we'll have more about that in just a moment.
Well, I know it's not my imagination. It's hot.
But first, international rescue and relief efforts continue amid widespread devastation in Nepal, where a massive 7.8 earthquake and multiple large aftershocks hit near the capital city of Kathmandu on Saturday. More than 5,000 now confirmed dead, 6,000 to 7,000 injured. The aftershocks are complicating rescue and relief efforts, reports BBC correspondent Justin Rowlett in the middle of an aftershock.
The earth is trembling again now, and the earth is really moving now. As you can see, everyone's running through the streets. It's actually quite hard to balance. Looking up at the buildings, worried that the buildings will fall again, because of course it's not actually the earthquakes that kill. Whoa, it's the falling buildings.
And that is exactly what earthquake experts warned about in Kathmandu just last week. They were there for a meeting to help the government prepare for this very scenario, warning of the massive risk created by the combination of rapid urban growth and weak-to-know building codes. But time was not on their side, and resilient infrastructure is a hedge against the impact of natural disasters like floods and earthquakes, and that can tip entire countries into destabilization.
So this is something that had been warned about
Yes.
for a long time, and nothing was done. They expected this to happen and failed to take action. Sounds disturbingly familiar, I'm sorry to say.
Meanwhile, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has announced that March 2015 was officially the hottest March on record globally. But it was even hotter in California. The first 3 months of this year...
See, I told you it was hot in California. I knew that in advance.
That's right. The first 3 months of this year in California, the average temperature was over 7 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than average, beating last year's record by 2 degrees and intensifying California's historic drought. And now that drought has spread to Washington State. Washington Governor Jay Inslee has declared an official drought emergency for nearly half of Washington.
I'll tell you what, all you climate change deniers out there, you deny to your heart's content. Wait until the drought comes to you, because it's coming. It's coming across the country. If the scientists are right about this, this could be a mega drought. It starts here in California, but it is spreading. Just saying.
Now, we've reported previously on the epidemic of starving baby sea lions washing up on West Coast beaches, and now we know why. Populations of their primary food source, sardines, have crashed more than 90% in just 7 years. That's due to overfishing and shifting ocean conditions. U.S. regulators finally listened to fisheries biologists and have canceled this year's commercial fishing season for sardines to give the species a chance to recover. Meanwhile, severe weather costs the U.S. economy as much as $33 billion a year in damages. And now, the U.S. Department of Agriculture is launching a broad new initiative to help farmers and ranchers build resilience and fight climate change. In a telephone press conference, Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack said farmers are already feeling the impacts of global warming.
They're seeing hotter temperatures. They're seeing longer droughts. They're seeing more frequent floods. They are seeing the impact of the changing climate, and they understand and appreciate the need to adapt and mitigate.
Now, one big part of this broad new initiative will harness the power of poo, specifically helping farmers to build biodigesters. These are tanks that capture methane from the millions of gallons of manure generated every day by U.S. herds, and that can be burned to generate electricity and income for the farms. It's part of a whole new broad comprehensive plan that will cut emissions and help farmers, ranchers, and forest managers earn money.
Yeah, but you're covering it because it's a story about poo, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. You love these poo stories. I don't know why. For much more on that story and the ones we couldn't get to, or I refuse to get to, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Don't forget you can download our reports anytime via iTunes, Stitcher, or TuneIn. Find us and follow us on the Facebook and the Twitters at Green News Report. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Ooh, that smell. Can't you smell that smell?
Ooh. Oh, the art of the well-chosen bumper music. Yeah, one of these times I would love to just DJ a show or make it all bumpers with Brad and Desi. Wouldn't that be a hoot? This is Titanic Tuesday on the Horn, 11 minutes before the hour of 8 o'clock. And let's go straight away to the Gizmo line. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob?
Yes?
Hi, it's Harry from Baltimore.
Hey, Harry, how are you?
Good, how are you? And I wanted to commend you on your filibuster tonight. I agree with everything you said, and I found it very moving. And as you know, I live here in Baltimore, although I'm still, I guess I consider myself an outsider because I've only been here about 2.5 years, but I am indeed living here in the city of Baltimore, and I've been watching and observing and trying to figure out what has gone on in the last 24 to 36 hours. But anyway, I'm happy to just talk about any aspect of it. And I didn't listen to your program last night, so I'm not sure how much you talked about it last night. So I just thought I'd check in.
I'm glad you did.
See what I could do to help.
One, it's nice to have a voice who's there, for starters.
Yeah, well, I hope I can be useful. That's what I said. I'd like to do anything I can do to help or to clear up anything that people are, confused about. And I must say, I think you're right that the national media in particular, and certainly Wolf Blitzer, but other national media as well, here, I can say even tonight, the 6 o'clock national news, they really do not understand what is going on here in Baltimore. Now, there are some local stations and one or two local reporters.
I applaud the woman from WBAL for sitting down and talking to those young men. Or standing there and talking to those young men.
Yeah, WBAL's, there's actually one reporter there named Jane Miller who is, I'm told, is actually not always used by them, but she is very intelligent and also seems to have a lot of experience with Baltimore. I guess she's been here a long time. And whenever she's on, I always listen because she, and I'm told that indeed she always says insightful and intelligent things.
Well, see, Harry, the thing, you said something that I think is trenchant a moment ago. You said that the national news all gets it wrong. Well, it's not like there aren't people there who can't explain it to them, so I can't help wondering if in the case of the national for-profit media, whether or not it's a case of there's none so blind as those who will not see. It's not that they don't understand. They have a narrative. They have a narrative. And you know what? This is whether it's Fox or CNN, okay? They have a narrative to advance.
Yes. Well, and in fact, what you played of, and I didn't either read or hear the whole Wolf Blitzer exchange with Duran McKesson, but no, I mean, as I actually mentioned to you earlier today, the Fox local news station, of course, is sounding very sort of militant and, martial law. But the other two stations, what I've watched, CBS and NBC, have been, tried to be, to figure out and to be as insightful as they could, you know, and even, of course, some of the anchors there, you know, have not been out in the field, or they're not that familiar. Maybe they've moved from other cities to be anchors in Baltimore. I wouldn't know because I haven't been here long enough to know who are the, you know, veteran anchors. But, yeah, the national media, as you said, I think they have this narrative and they're sticking to it. And even though the narrative, certainly, whatever the narrative was last night is now really breaking down in many different ways, and I can give some examples, they don't seem to get it.
And again, I don't think they want to get it. Because if you get it, then you have to do more than parachute in there and then disappear when the fires have been doused. Because, I mean, I've seen some of this, you know, I've seen some of this up close and personal.
Yeah.
I remember during the Upper Big Branch disaster when they parachuted in all the breathless for-profit media reporters to talk to those poor people, and you know, and they got, I don't know if you even know where that reference comes from, but
that's from Galaxy Quest, the satire movie about
yes,
Star Trek.
We need your help.
Great movie.
Yeah.
Exactly. We need your help. Yeah. Anyway.
But they come in and they get the sound bites from the lady who says, "Well, yeah, they killed my husband and my boy, but we always knowed that coal mining was dangerous." And having gotten that, they move on. And to be fair, because this is the nature of American so-called journalism, Harry, if it bleeds, it leads.
Yes.
And where's the story in hanging out after we found all the bodies? How are you going to get the attention of an America that can't think past the next episode of The Voice or America's Got Talent or whatever? You know, more Americans will vote in that silliness than will vote in the next election. How do you get the attention of an America that doesn't want to hear that the problems are more complex than the scary Negroes just got violent? I mean, you're in Baltimore. You tell me, what's that neighborhood like where Freddie Gray lived? What, around a third of the houses are empty? Property values are through the floor? One third unemployment?
Yes, that's all correct.
And I mean, so what is the media? I mean, what does America expect? What do the terrified white people expect that we're just going to drive through that part of Baltimore and see a bunch of happy shining black faces singing "Swing Low, Sweet Chariot"? Harry, what? And I'm not yelling at you. You know, I mean.
Oh no, I know that. Appreciate you saying that. No, look, first of all, I mean, you're the media veteran, and I seem to recall you worked for CNN in its early days, if I understand right.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. So anyway, no, you have much more experience in the media than I do, so I don't know what to say about the media, except to say, even, you know, frankly, even the local media, I suppose you could say, you know, the last night, and this all started, you know, only in the afternoon after the funeral was over. And it actually now seems like it started actually in a what is considered, frankly, a rundown and not very safe shopping mall in West Baltimore. And it seemed to have first actually involved. There are actually a number of high schools in that area who all often convert. Students will get out of school and converge on that mall.
And they'll go hang out at the mall,
near,
sure.
Right, but also it's near
a large
public transportation stop. So a lot of them just have to come through there. And there was apparently, you know, some sort of Twitter media thing saying, well, we're all going to go to the mall, you know, after school. But these were kids who, the police commissioner of Baltimore today was saying, you know, these were kids who were 14, 15, 16, et cetera. So at first, you know, people, you know, there's all this criticism from the right wing about, oh, why didn't you do something sooner? No, but the point is, at first it was just school children, or so it seemed. And then it kind of spread, and of course, you know, these kinds of things, as you know, I mean, they're often hard to, you know, explain how, where the spark is or where the, you know, where suddenly things take off in terms of crowd behavior. But it somehow did from there. And even though it ended up back there at that mall later in the evening at about 7:30, 8 o'clock, the fact is that that's sort of where it seems to have started. But you see, again, it's going to take, I mean, look, if one is a social scientist, this will take months, if not years, to really analyze, you know, how it all happened and why it happened, you know, yesterday. I mean, aside from, you know, the fact of the funeral, but that funeral was totally peaceful, and there were all sorts of, there had been protest marches on Saturday and Sunday, but they were all peaceful marches. And
well, let's be clear. I don't necessarily believe the meme that's being put out there that this was all started by a bunch of rambunctious school children.
Oh, no, I'm talking about I don't know what you want to call the proximate cause, immediate cause. I'm not talking about the underlying cause at all. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to imply that.
No, you didn't. I'm just saying that I don't even necessarily believe the business from yesterday about all the children deciding on Twitter that... It sounds too much like the children's crusade, frankly.
Yeah, well, it may not to be true, but that is the narrative that at least the police commissioner today, not yesterday, but today, this afternoon, at a late afternoon press conference.
Right, well, but the thing is, though, Harry, if we take that at face value, then let's ask some questions about the schools from which those children were coming.
No, they're poor school, no question.
Is any one of them adequately funded?
Probably not, no. And, in fact, as I mentioned, I mentioned this mall. It's called Mondawmin Mall. And, frankly, as I said, well, I'll tell you, middle-class people I know here have told me not to shop there because it's a very unpleasant, run-down, and probably in some ways unsafe place to be. So, no, you're starting out in a neighborhood that is, in a sense, already, downhill.
Behind the eight ball.
The mall itself has apparently become very run down. So, you know, we're talking about very bad economic conditions.
Right. Let's be clear. That mall's become run down, et cetera. Why is that? Well, you know, the community doesn't own that mall. That mall is owned by some giant, real estate holding company that has chosen to let it become run down.
Yes. Although I haven't been here long enough to know the history of that, but that's my impression. And certainly, yes. In fact, well, I can tell you this. There have been recently, this is so odd, competitions for new malls on the outskirts of Baltimore City where, in fact, there already are malls. And, in fact, there's one in particular that came up where a company wanted to build a new mall and was looking for tax breaks of all kinds from both the city and the county, I believe, is sort of on the line. And again, I can't, you know, some of these facts I'm sure haven't gotten quite accurately, but the point is, why were they building the new mall? They already had a mall there. Why wasn't that, you know, why wasn't
right, because,
the investment in that, right?
Because they're reverse tax harvesting. I mean,
and again,
this comes back to real journalism. Wouldn't it be interesting to go down to City Hall, down to the county courthouse and find out how much property tax was paid on that rundown mall last year?
Well, I don't know that, but again, you know.
Well, I know you don't, but I mean, you see my point.
Right. Oh, no, I do. What I'm saying, I was about to say was, in fact, in Baltimore City, the Baltimore Sun, in fact, has indeed run articles about all the tax breaks that Baltimore City has given away to developers in the Baltimore City leadership's attempts to build up Baltimore as a tourist attraction. So the areas people hear about, like the so-called Inner Harbor and that area near the water, Fells Point, and also this whole Inner Harbor Mall and the National Aquarium and all that, they're giving away tax breaks to developers. And this has been documented in the Baltimore Sun. Just amazing amounts of money, like $120 million, you know, in a tax break to some developer for some new building down there. And this is why some of the problem in Baltimore is actually very local. It has to do with the leadership of the city, which I'm sorry to say, the majority of the people involved are actually African American. We have a mayor who a lot of people of her race, including many of the people I know who are black, who think she is a terrible mayor and that she has, in a sense, either sold out or she, you know, wants, she's more concerned about posing and having photo opportunities than she is in really helping the city of Baltimore to regain its economic base or to build a new one. And instead, all she does is she hangs out apparently with developers and gives them tax breaks and, you know, shows up for every photo opportunity, but a lot of people feel that she's just a horrible mayor. Now, she was elected mayor in part because her father was a relatively popular, very popular politician before her, and actually was apparently a good man, did a lot of good things, good works.
That's the problem. The system, regardless of race, Harry, the system co-opts people. It's kind of like last night I saw an interview with Ben Jealous, past president of the NAACP.
Yes.
And he was identified as being a partner in a freaking hedge fund.
Exactly. And I have no doubt that when this mayor of Baltimore has finished her second term, or when she's not elected again, that she will end up, frankly, at some sort of similar kind of institution, an investment banking company or firm or something like that.
Think of it as 1% welfare.
It's
interesting. You know, you talk about the tax issues and the malls and everything. You reminded me of a book I read a lot of years ago by Greg LeRoy, and it was pretty splashy at the time. It was called The Great American Jobs Scam, Corporate Tax Dodging, and the Myth of Job Creation. And it has become no less, it is not losing relevance, it's gaining it. But oddly enough, when I went to the website for the book just a minute ago, right there... was you know how they print blurbs from the reviews of the books?
Yes, absolutely.
LeRoy argues persuasively that tax rates aren't the main thing driving business locations anyway. Tax discounts are just something to be extracted because companies have figured out they can do it. Guess where that came from, Harry? The Baltimore Sun.
You're kidding.
No.
I'm sad. It's tragic, but it doesn't surprise me because apparently that has been the kind of economic development theory of this mayor and this administration, and frankly many of the people currently on the city council.
Well, I don't necessarily like to do it, Harry, but I'm gonna put on my tattered velvet moth-eaten magician's robe with the frayed moon and stars and Will Thee Kiss Me in the Dark Baby in glow-in-the-dark paint across the front, and consult my busted magic eight ball that always says answer hazy, ask again later. And I can tell you, I can tell you what that neighborhood in West Baltimore will be in about 25 years' time. It will be full of happy, smiling, white faces once it's been gentrified by the real estate industry. And the people who live there have been driven out and elsewhere to go be miserable somewhere else.
Yes. Well, in fact, some of those blocks have been vacant already. They are vacant. And so, yes, and a lot of them are going to be gentrified. In fact, you can drive through, say, across Baltimore City, and it is very odd because you'll see lots of blocks and lots of buildings that are boarded up, and then suddenly there's a block that's been gentrified. And there's usually, there's a reason for it. Usually it may have to do with being near some new or some institution, or maybe one of the universities built a new, school or something nearby. But it is true. And what's even worse is that because the population of Baltimore has also shrunk, there is a lot of vacant housing that actually may never be gentrified, but that frankly is sitting there, and you have lots and lots of homeless people in Baltimore, or people who cannot afford even, subsidized housing. And there has been this kind of, fortunately, there are a few people around, the community leaders, saying, well, why can't we, move homeless people into these buildings? And in fact, I know someone, a friend of mine here, who was involved in the creation of a new, what's called a community land trust. And what they hope to do is basically to buy some of these vacant properties and fix them up and in a sense, rent them out to people of very, you know, of lower income who could not afford otherwise to live in them. And, you know, you may, I'm sure you've heard of community land trusts, and, but this is some, that, things like that are what Baltimore needs, because the city has either, if they own these properties, they've done nothing with them, and they certainly haven't turned them over. And what I'm also told is that banks, let's say, that own vacant properties, they refuse basically to give them, they don't want to just give them away. They're determined somehow to extract, you know, the maximum value from them.
Right, wealth extraction, absolutely. I mean, because money,
yes,
because capitalism.
Though, right, exactly, because money. And even though a lot of these properties, in fact, I once went to see one with a real estate agent, this was several months ago, it was vacant, and then the property was a mess, but the bank would not allow someone, you know, who could put up a certain amount of money to buy it. No, no, that was not enough for the bank. The bank wanted to hold on to it until they could get what they thought was what they needed, you know, money. I mean, enough money. And this indeed happened, and apparently this is another thing that goes on in Baltimore. These banks will not let go of these properties except, you know, and occasionally, and it's not even clear to me why they do it, they've just decided to let one go, or, you know. But,
and I can't help wondering how many of those properties may have been victims of the credit default swap, real estate bubble abuses.
Many of them. Apparently many of them, yes. Yes, a lot of them were foreclosed on, and yet, in a sense, the bank just is holding on to them. They won't let go.
And so the money didn't disappear, did it?
No, it did not. No. And in fact, a lot of these properties, frankly, are in nice places or are nice, you know, and I'm talking about properties actually relatively close to where I live. I live in a mixed middle class neighborhood, but let's say a mile away, you know, in fact, that's where this one property was. It was, now it's on a main drag, but still, and you know, it could be, you know, it could be, renovated with enough, you know, money to invest in it. But the point is that the bank, in a sense, would have to sell it at a low enough, you know, to a point where somebody could actually buy it to have the money to invest in it. You know, have money left over to invest in it and renovate it. And apparently that's not happening because the banks won't let go of these buildings.
And when we talk about banks, we're not talking about the little corner community bank
that used to serve communities. No.
We're talking about these giant deregulated behemoths, the Bank of America
bank,
and Wells Fargo, and
et cetera, Sundra, you know, big banks. Yeah, there are many local
banks left. Who, like the police, have absolutely no connection to the communities they allegedly serve. And I think
that is
also an essential component of this conundrum.
Yes, and activists here in Baltimore, as you know, have said that a lot of the police who work for the city police force, in fact, live either in Baltimore County, which is suburban, or else even, frankly, in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, remember, Darren Wilson drove to Ferguson every day from his little white community in elsewhere, Missouri.
Exactly. Same, very similar, apparently, dynamic here. Very few of these policemen actually live in Baltimore City. You know, so their connection with people, you know, here, they don't have any connection. And this is part of what the rage is about. Because the rage is really about, of course, police brutality, and the documentation, you know, here in Baltimore is clear. I mean, there's just been too many shootings, killings of African Americans, particularly African American men, you know, over the last 10 or 15 years in particular, although the problems police go back apparently at least certainly until since 1980, when there was the NAACP brought a lawsuit back in 1980. And then also there was zero tolerance policing, which was, believe it or not, introduced in the 1990s by, of all people, Martin O'Malley.
Really? Mayor
Martin O'Malley, yes, that's my understanding. Actually, some of this I'm getting, I got a press release today from the ACLU of Maryland, and they actually referenced an article in the New York Times from several days ago. I don't know if you referenced it in your programs before, but it goes back to the zero. Basically, what happened was in the 2000s, the police brutality and killings suddenly took off. Not suddenly, but they took off. And some of that had to do with the zero-tolerance policy that was adopted back in the late 90s, as I understand it. And Martin O'Malley, yeah. Martin O'Malley was the mayor of Baltimore from 1999 to 2007. So he developed the zero-tolerancing policing policy, and it was a crime-fighting strategy. And in a sense, it maybe it worked, but at the same time, what it meant was that many more people, mostly African-American men, were arrested, picked up, whatever. And in fact, in 2006, actually, the ACLU sued Baltimore, and the city settled in 2010 for about $870,000, and they supposedly publicly abandoned the zero-tolerance policing problem. But that didn't make the problem go away. And then in the early and mid-2000s, people started being killed, and this article goes into various people. And even now, even despite the Freddie Gray thing, terrible tragedy that happened recently, there's still on the table what happened in 2013. A man named Tyrone West, in his 40s, was in a car. He was stopped by the police, a routine traffic stop, and before it was over, he was dead. And he had a heart attack. It was, the coroner said he had a heart attack, but there was a struggle right at the car. And the city prosecutor declined to press charge against the police. And witnesses said Brother Mr. Tyrone West had been beaten, and the family has been pursuing this ever since. And they hired perhaps the best civil rights lawyer in Baltimore, a man named Dwight Pettit. And he is pursuing the case, and as you know, as a civil case, and suing them in the city.
And the, but you know, the sad thing is, and if we can describe it as such, Harry, and yeah. I suspect you well know, when the police get sued, there's seldom even if the plaintiff prevails, there's seldom any real world impact for the offending policeman, because A, all settlements involve explicit denials of liability.
That's right. That's correct.
And all monies and all monies are paid out of insurance coverage.
Right. And also, as I think I may have once mentioned to you in email, Maryland was one of the first states to adopt the so-called it's a Bill of Rights for law enforcement officers, law enforcement police Bill of Rights. And that started apparently in New York City, but Maryland was one of the first, or may have been the first state actually to adopt it. I don't know when they, I forget when they adopted it. But here's something from that article. It says, since 2010, and this is according to the ACLU of Maryland, just one Baltimore police officer has been prosecuted for killing a civilian. And this was an off-duty officer who was convicted of shooting a Marine Corps veteran outside a bar. Just one. And yet, and this has been documented both in this article and also in the Baltimore Sun, Baltimore police officers killed 127 people in the two decades ending 2012.
Jesus.
And then, and this, they said, according to the FBI, apparently there's no national database of police-involved killings, but the FBI apparently has a voluntary survey. And the New York Times went in and looked at that survey, and they said that other cities that were cited for the, you know, use and practice of excessive force, like Memphis, Seattle, Oklahoma City, New York Times says none reported more than half the number in Baltimore. And in fact, again, in late 2014, or sorry, the fall, the Baltimore Sun had this very long feature article about the fact that the city had paid out, since 2011, there were 102 lawsuits that were settled involving police misconduct. The city paid out $5.7 million. And on top of that, the city then paid out $5.8 million to law firms to help the city defend against those lawsuits. And this has just emerged that all of this money has been sent, that's over, you know, you can count, it's over $10 million for these 102 lawsuits since 2011. I'm sorry, judgments or settlements in lawsuits since 2001.
And
so,
of course,
you know, I don't think
and the frustrating thing out of that is that it would be nice to say, well, you know, if the cops weren't out there torturing people, that money could have been used in the community. But it couldn't have. But it couldn't have because that's just a matter of paying premiums and insurance companies paying out when they have to.
I don't remember the details from the article. You're probably right. On the other hand, of course, the Baltimore Sun, you know, said what, you know, but look at what this could possibly have, you know, meant to the city. But yes, you're probably right. Settlements probably were mostly insurance. So.
Well, Harry, it has been a magnificent conversation. We haven't talked in a while, and I'm really, really glad you called in.
Well, I just want to check in, but certainly I want to let other people call and ask whatever they want. And if there are questions, you know, I can even answer by email and let you know if there's something that people really want to know. But I'm just glad that you're talking about this. You know, we don't Baltimore, I guess, is south, but not much south. But I, you know, commend you for your what you said in the first hour and a half, all of which I thought was absolutely, you know, correct and needed to be said.
Thank you, Harry. Thank you very kindly. It is always, whether it be by email or by phone, it is always a genuine pleasure to hear from you, and I hope you know that.
Well, you're very kind, and actually it's always my pleasure to listen to your program every night, and so I thank you for that.
Have a great evening,
and take care.
And as things develop, please don't hesitate to holler back, okay?
I'd be happy to.
All right. Thanks, Harry.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye now. Our good friend Harry in Baltimore. And Harry kind of brings, he kind of shines a light on what I mean when I say that conversation radio is a concept whereby we prove that we ourselves are the experts. I think there was probably a little bit, a great deal more reality in that conversation in the content provided by Harry than anything you're likely to see or hear coming from the mouth of, say, Wolf So Poor So Black Blitzer in the next 100 years. You get my meaning? Yeah. And speaking of, let's bounce over to the Skype line where the angry Indian awaits. Angry, what's happening?
No, my Appalachian brother. A lot of fucking chaos is what's happening. But you mentioned John Brown earlier.
Yeah, I don't know why my mind went there, but it was almost like it was dragged there, Angry.
Because if you're going to really talk about this situation, if you're going to talk about, you know, fucking police brutality and the role of the police and, you know, the Pinkertons and slave catchers and all of that. You know, the whole idea of keeping an oppressed group in a repressed position to where they have to gasp for air. You know, I mean, that's what we're really talking about. And it's really, we've seen this pattern before. I'm looking at Mother Jones right now, which is about as liberal, I suppose, as you can get. And they're saying, and they're not supporting violence, they don't support rioting. But they're saying that the way that this started was pretty much the authorities were already, you know, they had already mustered. And when children were leaving a local school, they basically surrounded these kids. And if they were grouped in anything more than like two at a time, they were surrounded by officers. Now, again, I don't know how true this is, but this is what eyewitnesses who spoke to Mother Jones are saying. The story was by Sam Brody and Jenna McLaughlin. So, you know, people can go check it out at MotherJones.com. They're saying that the police, just pretty much like with Ferguson, the way that they came down with a heavy fist, scaring people, pushing people. And last night, while you were talking about this, there was traffic on Twitter showing video, I suppose it was on Vine, and still photographs of police throwing bottles and rocks at protesters.
Yeah.
So, you know, what the hell is really going on here? And now Fox News is accusing the, what is it, the mayor or the someone who's of authority over there, that the protesters were told that they could do whatever they wanted and the police will not stop you.
Well, Well, what is okay? Help me here, because I have seen that clip almost. It's almost like it's on a loop now, of the mayor saying, "And we were giving them space to do damage, or space to do destruction, or space to be destructive." The hell is that?
Yeah, I don't know. I can kind of suss out what that meant, because I have not heard that clip. I've been seeing mentions of it. And a couple of people said something to me today about it, but I haven't heard it. The only thing that I can think of, because didn't she do a press conference wearing a baseball cap and a sweatshirt?
That one I didn't see. But that clip about, you know, space to destroy or whatever has driven the right wing out of their tiny, itsy-bitsy, microscopic little minds today.
Yeah.
I got, for instance, we've talked in the past about the bizarre damn things that I get from the right wing out there day to day. Well, I got one from Americans for Prosperity today. No, I'm sorry, Americans for Limited Government. And I can't keep up with all the Orwellian names, angry. Baltimore. Let's see, getliberty.org's broadcasters, daily talking points for the airwaves. Because this shit exists on the right wing. They don't fund this kind of thing hardly at all on the left. But Baltimore riots marked city's tourism suicide note. I wanted to give space to those who wish to destroy. That is how Baltimore Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake described her policy, which effectively told police to stand down as hoodlums. Smashed store windows, looted 7-Elevens, and forced attendees at a Baltimore Oriole-Boston Red Sox baseball game to remain in the stadium because it wasn't safe outside.
Well, I like I said, I'm just going to throw this out here because I did not see that clip. I've heard it was on video, so obviously she stuck with it. She's going to have to own that. But I'm thinking that being caught unawares, not thinking about every minute. Little fissitude that is going to be dissected by those over at Fox. That, okay, we're going to, you know, give them enough space to allow this to burn out a little bit. Because if the police rush in, we know what's going to happen. Black people are going to get hurt, and then it's going to get worse, and it's certainly going to goddamn look bad, and the police are going to look even worse, and then we're going to have another problem, because each name now would be added to the hashtags of somebody who got fucked up by the police. And if somebody loses their goddamn life, well, I'm going to be held responsible. The police are going to be held responsible no matter what the fuck happened, because when these sorts of things happen, what do they call it, the fog of war? It really is goddamn happened. It is hard to tell what the fuck went down. I know, because I used to do this goddamn shit. And, you know, it can be somebody who was probably a fucking undercover cop, who was three people behind you, that threw that goddamn rock or bottle.
That's exactly it, Angry. I was having I was having a conversation earlier today with a friend of the program who comes from labor, and I said, labor, more than anybody, knows the definition of agent provocateur.
Mm-hmm. Or should know.
Remember the video footage out of, what was it, Quebec a few years ago, where they stone-cold busted an undercover Mountie trying to incite violence.
Yep. Pulled them right out.
It happens time after time after time. Because, and see, this is the part I don't have a hard time wrapping my head around. The cops, let's be straight up about this. The cops love this stuff. You got all that training, you got all that equipment, and you never get to use it? You're telling me when the call goes out that there's a riot, that the adrenaline doesn't rush and the blood doesn't pump, and the black leather gloves go on and the riot shields come out and the truncheons and the helmets and the face shields, and by God, we're going to go kick some ass. There's no way that isn't a reality.
Yes, a reality, and they're encouraging it. You know, it's part of the, you know, reason why you're here. You know, this is fun. You get to smash on people. I mean, anyone who is honest, who knows anyone who has ever served in any branch of the military will tell you the most boring thing about being in the military is peacetime. Because if you're in special forces or whatever the hell, if you're a combat marine and there's really, you know, they're talking war, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and you actually don't have one to go to. You know, I mean, yeah, you get some fellas to go in, they want to be mechanics and whatever because they're trying to pay for college. But you also get a lot of people who are very honest about it. I want to go in because I want to, you know, do this stuff. And you also have a culture, we've been talking about this. You've had other people talked about this who were much more articulate, about this than me. That, you know, you have these games. You know, the soldier and all of us. I mean, how fascist is that? How Spartan is that?
Oh.
This is a regression. And people don't realize it.
Well, I'm probably making of it a greater symbol than it was, but the last week's episode with the two Swedish police officers on the train in New York.
Yeah, everybody's kind of like playing with this in a lot of different ways.
Well, but the fact of the matter is, in what we call the civilized world, I know, but policing is completely differently understood in other parts of the so-called developed world than we understand it here.
Well, see, that's one of the things you have to point out, because the way police react in Spain towards Africans, towards Arabs, is as bad as they treat, you know, black people here, Mexicans here, you know. Police in Africa, do you really want to run into the police in Africa?
No, and seven or eight people were executed in Malaysia today for alleged drug crimes.
Yeah, and they let the world know about that above board, because in the Philippines, they just take you out to a field and that's the end of it. You got cops over there named Rambo, because they're known for extrajudicial executions. I'm talking about the Philippines now, a U.S. ally. You know, I mean, in many ways, one of the reasons why the far right, or, you know, and I'm saying the far right, I'm referencing Fox News, you know, can say, oh, well, you should be glad that you're in the U.S. if you're a Negro, is because they really do know how the police are in other countries. People disappear. I mean, there's been allegations of black men, usually of Haitian descent. I mean, this is the word that I got through the grapevine, that, you know, black men disappear or used to disappear in Toronto. In the 80s and early 90s. You're taken into custody, your family never sees you again. But you're not really on record taken into custody either. You know? I mean, this is a problem. This has always been a problem. In Brazil, police execute homeless people there all the time for fun and profit. And the United States knows about this and continues to train their police forces, continues to train their commanders. The School of the Americas is still open.
Oh, hell yeah. And see, but Angry, that's the difference. That's the dichotomy I was trying to set up. We have allies who disappear people. We really do. And we have allies who chop heads off in the middle of the street. You know,
yep.
Our good friends, the Saudis. And right-wingers point to those cultures and say, well, you know, they don't have much of a crime problem, do they? I mean, remember the right wing screams for blood when some American was going to get caned in Singapore?
Yeah, was it Singapore? He was chewing gum or something in public.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's a right wing wet dream. But the reality is, for instance,
but they didn't like it when it was going to happen to that blonde kid, because I remember all of the brouhaha over that, and they were demanding sanctions, they were demanding troops be sent to bring him out. There were editorials like that, and you know, and there were also some people, just like you said, who said, yeah, we should have that here, because that way, you know, these kids will be more careful with the ice cream cones. I mean, there were some elders who were talking crazy like that. Because when people get scared and they think that everything is out of control, you know, whatever is outside of their immediate transparent bubble is outside of control, then, hey, send the Marines. Send nukes if you have to. Exterminate everybody if you need to.
Right. But
I want to be able to have my iced tea and be calm.
But on the other hand, in, say, an Australia or a Germany, if a police officer discharges his weapon, it is a big damn deal.
Yeah, they have to answer for that. They have to account for everything. They have to account for all of that. Yeah, and they really
I know I'm speaking in broad generalities, and I'm sure there are exceptions to the rule, but there are
especially
not.
If you're a black fella, sure.
But there are not nearly the exceptions. See, I guess, yeah, there are exceptions. But over here, the exceptions are the rule.
Yeah.
Does that make
all
sense?
Over there, too, you know.
I mean, you know, police, we tend to view everything in this country through the amber-tinted lens of backward glancing. You know, we like the vision of the portly beat cop walking the sidewalk spinning his billy club. Ah, good morning, Mrs. McGillicuddy. How are you today? Ah, fine, Patty, and you? And it's a stereotype, but it becomes a stereotype because it's real. Or was real.
Well, somewhat.
But that was, you know, that's policing. And, of course, we won't go into how many were on the take or corruption, all of that.
Yeah.
but it's a far different thing when your entire country has become an armed camp. And we have a method of, and it's something I wrote on Facebook last night. Immediately, if you complain about police, there's always some jackass on Facebook who will say, well, but not all police are like that. And, you know, I know police who aren't like that. So, okay, let's take that as read. But all policing is like that. I mean, the operative philosophy of paramilitary police is the paradigm for modern American policing now.
Yeah, well,
it's inescapable.
It's been for a while, but there was always congressmen and there was always senators who stood up and said, you know what? And they were usually conservatives, I have to say this, you know, like Barry Goldwater types, who usually stood up and said, wait a minute, you're going too goddamn far with this. Now, Nixon came up with the legislation. You know, mostly because they were going after the Black Panther Party for self-defense under what was called New Kill and Chesimard, you know, which is related to Assata Shakur, which is still in exile in Cuba. When, you know, there were police officers who were being shot in confrontations with Black Power advocates / radicals / revolutionaries / protesters. You know, depending on whose versions of events that you want to take, and including COINTELPRO. I mean, these were all the Black Desk. I mean, you know, these were things that were run by the authorities against the Black Revolutionary Movement for decades. You know, I mean, we found out very recently through Freedom of Information Act request that the grandfather of Martin of the King family of Martin of the Reverend Dr. King was under surveillance from the feds. So they've been watching that family for a long time. We found out the same thing about the Tupac Shakur's family. They've been under government surveillance for generations. So, you know, yeah, this is not a new problem, but when it comes to the paramilitary thing, that is the code word. Now, what is the main difference between the United States and most other republics? There is one major difference.
Don't keep me in suspense.
No, really, you don't know? The idea that the army cannot move on the main.
Oh, posse comitatus.
Posse comitatus. The whole idea was, anybody that has read any history books will know, whoever has the loyalty of the army, be it businessman, be it the people, that is who normally controls things. Because, as Mao Zedong said, whoever has the guns makes the rules, not the gold, you know, because they can take the gold from whoever the hell, if they want to, under arms. Rome found that out, right? The hard goddamn way. You know, Carthage found that out the hard goddamn way. You know, this is not, you know, being ridiculous to bring up these historical, you know, incidences. You know, they specifically had it here, if we allow the army to not be under civilian control, if we allow the police to not be under civilian control, they can do whatever the hell they want, and they will do whatever the hell they want because power corrupts. We understand this. And they've been working ever since Nixon to remove that line, that legal line. And they've been doing so. And the business community is 100% behind this because they don't give a damn about how many people get damaged. They live in gated communities. It's not their sons that are going to be picked up. It's not their daughters that are going to be abused like the, by that cop in Oklahoma. How many women did he abuse? Holtzclaw.
Yeah.
And how many people donated to his defense fund?
Well, and by the way, while we're taking steps down this road, just because it's Titanic Tuesday, angry, can we take a moment here to note that presidential candidate and progressive hero Rand Paul and that thing on his head has decided to open his mouth and prove his ignorance, declaring today that the problems in Baltimore stem from the fact that black youth in Baltimore don't have fathers and they don't have proper parenting. Says the guy whose teenage kid, just got busted for his second DUI.
Yeah, but see, but that doesn't matter. I mean, look at the Palin family. I mean, goddamn. I mean, if we're going to talk about, you know, all kinds of stereotypes about poor white folks, you know, I mean, they fit the entire fucking bill. I mean, Alaska is not exactly the garden spot of the goddamn world if you want to be a snob. You know, but she's out there running her mouth, taking Indian service health care for one of her children while she's against Indians getting any kind of goddamn benefit at all, you know, for being colonialized, right?
Right.
You know, so it's like, you know, the hypocrisy stands. But like I said, you know, John Brown. I was taught in school that John Brown was a maniac.
Oh, so, Jesus, I grew up in Alabama. What do you think I was taught?
Oh, I know what you were taught. We were taught that he was a maniac. But at the same time, I was told that David Ben-Gurion was a hero.
Yeah.
Well, see, there's contradictions there.
And this is, and you know, you only find out different by studying and by listening to other points of view. You know, of John Brown, Frederick Douglass said,
you're going to get us all killed.
No, okay, so maybe there was that too. No, Frederick Douglass said, I could live for my race, but he could die.
Yeah, he made a point. I mean, look, a lot of people don't like to hear this, but any real black revolutionary who's serious out there, intellectually speaking, knows what I'm talking about. John Brown was blacker than everybody around him. He was the blackest man in America in many ways. You know, because he realized that they're not going to let you go because you asked them to. And they're not going to do it because, well, hey, I guess I just decided that it's really wrong that we've been doing this and I'll start paying your wage. How's that? No, you know, that wasn't going to happen. Somebody was going to have to say, fuck this, we're done. And he militarily could have succeeded if he had the proper support from the North. But see, you know, what was the other factors in that, right? You had England supporting the South, and then you had a lot of industrialists in New York who were also supporting the South. So they didn't want any part of this. And the American Colonization Society, while they were against slavery in the United States, they just didn't want black people in the United States. They wanted, you know, and ended up founding Liberia, and look at what the hell was going on with that. That was a front for the United States.
Yeah.
That was a colonializing front.
Further colonization. And you could argue one of the earliest attempts at colonization.
Mm-hmm. Well, basically,
extra North American colonization.
Yeah, Liberia was Israel before Israel. It was the same thing, because these are black people who went there and started running roughshod all the native black people who were from there already. Because they felt that they were American, this is what they were brainwashed with, and they went over there for Firestone and whoever the hell else. I forget the companies that they ended up fronting for, you know, but it was the same thing. It was the exact same thing. But we're not going to talk about that. We're not going to talk about native sterilization. You know, I mean,
that was the larger point that I was trying to reach, Angry, is that we have, you know, we pigeonholed John Brown, and we pigeonholed what John Brown said about the future of this country. And once the Civil War was over with, well, John Brown was right. You know, there was a lot of blood. There had to be a lot of bloodshed, and you know, now we're over it. So yay, hooray! Somebody make lemonade and. We'll all sing the Star Spangled Banner. But his prophecy, if we can call it that, is still at work, Angry.
Because it was never dealt with. He was fighting to stop slavery. They were fighting to keep the country in one piece. There's a difference.
Oh, absolutely. That may be, it's not particularly funny, but that may be the toaster comment of the evening. There's a profound difference. But let's understand something, and this is something I usually say in the context of gun violence, we're horrified because school children were chopped to pieces in Newtown, Connecticut, but don't worry, it will happen again, because this country isn't interested in anything resembling a real solution to the problem.
No.
And the same thing, how many people, I don't have transcripts, but I'll bet you somewhere along the way during the conversations about Ferguson, I'll bet you we said, it will happen again. I'm almost 100% that we said it will happen again.
We did, because we knew it was going to happen. And seeing what really got people, fucked up about this one is that all this fellow did was look at this cop. Now, I'm telling you from personal fucking experience, that chick can get you goddamn fucking fucked up, because it happened to me. All I did was look at this fucking guy. All right? That's all the fuck I did. Now, I survived it. But see, there's some white man listening to this right now talking about, maybe you did something. No, motherfucker, I didn't. I was in
a
bad place.
Let's be careful. This is a pretty special little community here. Maybe we got some right-wing lurker, but, yeah.
But this is one of the things that, again, that has to be discussed about this. You have a lot of white liberals who are like, well, not me. Well, hey, like I said, I just saw this, big goddamn movement to go after a pizzeria and go after an entire fucking state because they didn't want to, support gay rights. And there was a change made. Now, we got black people here getting fucked up just because they looked at a goddamn white cop, had his neck broken, and then his spine fucked up in 8 other goddamn different areas and shit. And then they rough ride him to the fucking station. And all the goddamn black cat that is in a white shirt can say is, you need to control your children. Not that we need to control the motherfucking cops, but that we need to control the kids. And see, I don't see a whole bunch of, white people, liberal and otherwise. Yes, there are white people out there protesting this. Of course there are. Yes, there are white people like you and most of the listeners, I assume, that are from your area who do not think that this is a good goddamn thing and really wish that they could fucking do something. But the fucking bottom line is, a handful of people can't do a goddamn thing. If the majority of white people were really supportive of fucking equal rights, this wouldn't be happening in the first goddamn place. And they would be forcing
to
do something.
But the magic word you just used was majority. There was a story in the Washington Post today, Angry, about these studies that are developing of search terms that are used on Google, because you can research them. And by looking for places where people have used that particular epithet that I really don't like to use, recognizing that also it's kind of a cop-out to say N-word or whatever, but people who have searched that, by looking at it, they mapped where people have searched it the most and the least. And damned if the stripe from Vermont all the way down the Appalachians into the southeast isn't blood red for the usage of the word in search terms. And so when you say a majority, that's a loaded word. Because you can get a majority of Americans to say, well, hell no, I ain't no racist. You can get that. But when they're by themselves in their private moments, or when they think nobody's looking, or when they think they're around people who will be agreeing with them, it's an entirely different story. And so, there's a majority out there that says they don't that they aren't racist. But there is a loud-ass plurality out there, and they go variously by the names of Americans for Freedom, Americans for Limited Government, Americans for Limited Americans for Prosperity, the Tea Party. And they aren't a majority. but they are a noisy enough plurality that working within the flawed system that is the American style of government, they are able to stymie anything resembling progress. That's why I said when I mentioned the word reparations earlier this evening, I said, and I understand that drives people crazy and that nothing even remotely smacking of that is ever going to go forward. But it really is. Truth and reconciliation and reparation are the only way you're ever going to stop the next Baltimore or the next Ferguson or the next St. Louis or the next place that this is going to boil over.
Well, yeah, I mean, you'll stop those, but see, here's the thing. They had the Truth and Reconciliation hearings, and you had white fellas sit there and talk about how they murdered this woman's son by, you know, crushing his skull, and he was hugged and forgiven, and he went on about his life, and she had to live with this, and they didn't have these anti-white riots. But in the meantime, the police force, which is now... You know, I mean, well, the police force, you know, both rank and file was always majority Native Africans. And they would separate the units by tribal affiliation. But their commanders were always white. And nothing has changed. I mean, it's just like 70s Africa, 60s Africa, 50s Africa, right? During the Congo crisis and what have you. Nothing's changed. You know, Anglo-American didn't lose any money. More than 86, 88% of the arable land in South Africa is still owned by, you know, Caucasians for the most part. And yeah, you know, they have given land and other certain things to Native Africans, and a lot of them have botched it because you're giving somebody with a third grade education, telling them to manage a farm, in which they've never worked on a farm. They came out of a shanty town. And then you accuse them of failing because, you know what, because they were black, I guess, because, you know, they had no training, so they didn't know what to do. And this happened under Mandela. You know, black faces in high places is just giving us a lot of black eyes. I mean, with Obama, I mean, you know, with Holder. I mean, what has the new attorney general said about the riots in Baltimore? You know, she's...
Talk about welcome to your new job.
You know, I mean, she's behind the police. She's behind the death penalty. She's behind, you know, this heavy...
Because sentencing. You can't reach into the power structure of this country and not be. That's part and parcel, Angry, of what I keep saying about understanding the modern nature of the American experience. This is an empire, and empires do not behave, do not enact benign liberal policies. They don't. They just don't. God, I wish they did. But they don't. And when your police from sea to shining sea are militarized out the gazoo angry, nobody who isn't willfully ignorant of the situation will call that anything but fascism.
We've talked about democratic fascism, right? But the point is, why were they militarized in the first place? Why were the Irish, who when they were brought here, and the Scots-Irish, they were many, not all, were indentured slaves. But the Anglos started giving them guns when Shays' Rebellion went down, right? And then you had the various other rebellions, Nat Turner, what have you, Denmark Vesey. Well, that never got off the ground, but... You know, the point was, okay, well, we didn't like you before, but we like you now. So here's this. And they gave them whatever they needed and whatever, you know, rules were broken, if they had any rules. You know, even with native slave catchers, they could do whatever they wanted to you. They just had to bring you back alive. If they scarred you up, if they fucked you up, if they raped you all the way, you know, on the way back, that was okay. You know, you got back in one piece and he got paid and he went on to the next one. This is part of the culture here. It always has been. You know, and if you ask, like, the average Cherokee out there, well, hey, why were you guys involved in the Civil War, what have you? Well, they were trying to protect their investment. It split the nation. It split the nation to this goddamn day. One, you know, you got Oklahoma, right? You got some people in New Mexico. Then you got the Eastern Band in North Carolina. So, you know, we're looking at this and being, you know, totally in denial about the entire goddamn thing. You have to be. You know, you have to be. You'd have to ask questions about Puerto Rico, Guam, Hawaii. You'd have to ask why there's military bases all over the goddamn place. Who's paying for this? You're paying for this. I'm paying for this. You know, how do you explain all of this? And then we want to look you know, befuddled when we find out that, you know, tear gas canisters that are being used in Israel, they're also being used in Ferguson, being used in Baltimore, being used in Chicago, being used in New York, being used in Philly against people protesting against police brutality. Whereas if somebody had their neck broken and their spine damaged in 8 different spots and was treated the way Freddie Gray was in another country, Fox News, Barack Obama, everybody would be crying for the civil and human rights of that individual. What about the social justice? Where is the UN? Why
right,
don't they
because we are exempt from our own critiques of race.
Precisely. The same reason when the Senate defended the Ku Klux Klan here in the 50s, when they came up with the 1948 law against genocide, the punishment and prevention of genocide. I can't remember the exact thing, but anybody can look it up. It's 1948. It's a UN law. It's a resolution. Now, the United States is not a full signatory to that law. Why is the United States not a full signatory? Because it was, you know, brought up in the United Nations, okay, that the Ku Klux Klan is a terrorist organization that preys upon blacks, Jews, and Native Americans, and that if the United States is a full signatory, they would have to go after the Ku Klux Klan. And they said, hell no. And they got a special dispensation where they are not a full signatory. They only are a partial signatory. So they cannot be held to the full extent of this ruling. Now, every American should understand that the Klan was defended by the United States government because they decided that they would not go after the Klan.
Right. And if there's any dialogue to be had, Angry, I guess this is the $64 million question. How do you get through to that offended white person who says, well, I ain't never owned no slaves. I ain't part of the problem. How do you even open the dialogue with them? Because we all know that a lot of minds greater than our own have tried to climb that Everest and have come back down in dejection.
Well, first off, you're wasting your time trying to convince somebody who's going to seek hire you to get a reaction before you even have the conversation.
But what if they're not skinheads? What if they're not Aryan Nation? What if they really legitimately call themselves non-racist and would no sooner utter that word than eat a mouthful of shit?
Well, first off, they got to get into a discussion on what the fuck racism really is. Racism is not hating any goddamn buddy. That's bigotry. That's bias. Racism. Whether you accept it or not, you are Caucasian. And in this social system, you have privileges. You have privileges, whether you want to admit it or not. Now, I can say that because that's the truth and that's what it is. But if the person is not receptive to understanding that and is going to really say to me, well, wow, you know, there's a black guy getting killed by the police every 28 hours or less in the United States. This not happening with white guys when they riot over pumpkins or to defend pedophiles and shit from Pennsylvania. You know, we can have a sports riot and, you know, they don't do that to our kids. Matter of fact, James Holmes can walk into a theater and kill how many goddamn people and look all crazy and have
and walk out alive.
And walk out alive and go to trial. You just had that, what was his name? Some white supremacists, they just caught tattoos all over the goddamn place, murdered these people. They had to taser him. There were white supremacists on Twitter talking about, oh, well, he didn't give the police a hard time. That's why they didn't shoot him. That was a motherfucking lie. They had to taser him. It took 6 of them to get him just on the ground. You understand what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
Every time he's had an interaction with the law, he's assaulted police officers. But they didn't shoot him. He has a record of beating up cops, but they didn't shoot him.
No. He might, among other things, he might lawyer up. Or could it be that the police forces, look, I understand that the police generally keep their hair cut short because if they get into a fracas, people pull hair. That's the way it was always explained to me. But it's hard to look at them with their shorn heads and not see a skinhead. And not wonder if, you know, not wonder if maybe one or two of them are going to Stormfront, because in Charleston, West Virginia, in the last 6 months, we found out that's damn sure to be true, because a Charleston police officer, white guy, kitted out his little girl in police gear and had her lip syncing to an American neo-Nazi anthem on video.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's your United States police forces. I mean, that's, you know, how they look doesn't really mean anything. I mean, you have a lot of black cops that will hurt you. You know, look at some of these videos. They're not just getting beat up by white cops. They're getting beat up by cops.
And finally, because we're running out of time, one little observation. All the video today, eventually you would see the precious and heartbreaking, in a way, more than a way, footage of the little black kid pushing a broom outside the burned up CVS. And somebody stuck a microphone in his face and said, "Why are you here?" And he said, "Because I wanted to rebuild this CVS, and I care about my community." And I watched it, and of course it did exactly what it was designed to do. It plucked the strings of my heart. And on the one hand, I thought, isn't that charming? His parents are teaching him to care about his community. That's what has to happen. That's the way it has to be. But then the nasty, cynical old Bob that lives on my left shoulder said, "Yeah, and why aren't there people who actually have jobs doing that kind of thing getting paid to be there and do it in that community?" And I guess because I'm a jerk.
No, but I'll just mention this. Floyd McKissick, who used to run the original CORE, the original on Congress for Racial Equality, I think it was based in New York City. He said, "Hey, you know, when they were burning up Harlem after Martin Luther King was assassinated," he's like, "who gives a goddamn if Harlem burns up or not?" He says, "Nobody black owns any fucking thing in Harlem. It's not theirs. The street is not theirs." I'm paraphrasing.
Right, that's what I was talking about with Harry when I said it's not like that mall that's described as being run down and everything. It's not like that mall is owned by the community. Hey, Angry, I got to get right out of here right now, brother. You take care.
All right, support the show, please, if you can. Peace.
Thanks. Our buddy the Angry Indian, thanks for two wonderful conversations this evening. I'm going to run over by a minute or so. But I want to share with you as well a note that just came in from our buddy Michael in Madison. Just a little something to think about until we get to prayer meeting Wednesday, when we will be having a fascinating conversation tomorrow evening, by the way. Michael in Madison says, "Regarding the Baltimore mayor's allowing space to destroy comment, I'm not dismissing angry speculation or yours or anyone's. Who knows what the hell she meant? We'll probably never really know, because she'll forever have to spin it any time she's asked what she meant. However, here's what occurred to me, an excerpt from a post my cousin in Milwaukee made today. Regarding the situation in Baltimore, this is a script I have seen many times, and sadly we will see again. Act 1, authority abuses its power, is exposed as corrupt. Act 2, peaceful protests organize with an inevitable faction of violent protesters that break off. Act 3, police leave squad cars and storefronts unprotected, allowing vandalism to rule the media coverage. Result, burning vehicles and broken windows become the face of the story, which authority points to as justification for their abuse of power, which inevitably goes unpunished. I'm not saying this as a conspiracy theorist. I have seen this on the ground with my own eyes at numerous protests. And we will see this again and again. The more authority abuses power, the more fomented anti-authority rage becomes." So Michael says, "Anyway, there's probably a ton of truth to my cousin's three-act play summation. So is it possible that as mayor, she's privy to the Baltimore police script, which, of course, the media and the proles aren't supposed to be privy to, and she let slip the Act 3 playbook? Didn't mean to, but oops, accidentally let a bit of truth slip out. I'm posing this as a possibility for your consideration, not claiming to know what the mayor meant." Signed, Michael. I think it's absolutely possible. Because it makes an abundance of sense within a broader context. And thank you this evening to Paul and to Gwen, to Texas T, to our anonymous contributor, and to Dan, all of whom helped us meet and finish Tom's Made It to the End of April challenge. Thank you very kindly. We'll be back tomorrow evening with Prayer Meeting Wednesday and a very, very, I think, engaging conversation. I hope you'll join us, the Hornedanistas and all of us, for that conversation tomorrow evening. Have a wonderful night. Bye now.